This episode, as well as all the others, are a production of Whitefields Educational Foundation, and you can make donations to support this podcast, as well as other podcasts and projects that are part of Whitefields. Go to whitefieldseducational.org or mormonexpression.com. Thank you. Back to another episode of Mormon Expression, and we have a wonderful panel. I am your host, Lindsay, and we have sitting with me today, Malia. Can you say hello?
Hi, how's it going?
We also have Ki'imi back for some more Mormon Expression fun. Can you say hello?
Hello.
And the person that you've all wanted to hear is Zilpha, and she's here. We wouldn't do this without her. Zilpha.
Hello, Lindsay. Hello, everybody.
So
hey,
today,
Zilpha.
Hey.
We're going to talk about something, and we brought in Ki'imi, one man and three girls, because we wanted to talk about if LDS men and women can be friends. We're going to explore the social and romantic dynamic of LDS men and women. And so we're going to get started, and we're going to talk about kind of the problems that Mormon men and women face in interacting socially and romantically. And do you trust your spouse alone with someone from the opposite sex? And are they going to have an affair on you on Facebook? And those kind of questions that come up in your wards and in your nightmares. So let's get started. First, I'm just going to ask that question, and I just want to hear everyone's yes or no answer. Can LDS men and women be friends? What say you, Zilpha?
Married? No, not really.
Okay, Malia, what do you say?
I say yes, they can, but do they? Not without funny looks.
That's what I mean. Like,
okay,
not that they
can't,
but that they don't.
Sometimes.
Oh, look. So it sounds like we've got a lot of good things to talk about tonight. Well, let's first talk about the historical context of men and women in society in general, how they interact, and if men and women have been able to have avenues to be friends, or if this is a new thing that we're dealing with.
Sure.
Okay, Amy, you're going to talk about Paul and the scriptures. Do you want to bring us in with that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we want to start with the scriptural context here, but no, the scriptural context is actually kind of weird, right? I mean, there's a whole complicated conversation that Paul has about relationships, where Paul basically says that the best thing in the world is to not have, you know, best thing in the world is to not have sexual relationships. The best thing in the world is to be celibate. And marriage is kind of a second best option for people who can't be cool and celibate, like Paul is. And in fact, this leads...
The second coming was supposed to be happening imminently, right?
Right, yeah. They had a different set of assumptions then. Right. There were
so what, you're only like holding out until Jesus comes?
Well, and there was... Paul wasn't the only one. I mean, there were these groups that were focused on celibacy and virginity, on the cult of Tekla being one, celebrating women who refuse to marry men or have sex with men and who are virgins for God. So, yeah, there was
I'm
this
a virgin for God. Aren't you?
You're a virgin for God?
Who isn't?
I wonder, though, how that fits in with the Adam and Eve story and the multiply commandment.
Yeah, how did Paul reconcile that?
Does Paul reconcile anything? There was this is the tension.
Paul was
right?
afraid of women. Can we just put that out there?
Yes. Yeah, and there's a constant tension, right? I mean, part of the power of religion is that it regulates people's most important relationships, including sexual relationships, and sometimes regulates them entirely out of existence.
That's true. Well, I mean, in society, men and women, what were their purposes to interact?
Well, and that's the other thing, right? I mean, obviously the role of women in ancient society is complicated, but the 32nd version is it sucked. that women did not have access to the same sorts of educations. Women did not have the same sort of social opportunities. When you look at a lot of ancient cultures, including, you know, the Bible, it's about how men can have these wonderful friendships with other men that are better than relationships with women, right? That's David and Jonathan. They have a relationship that's better than women. Aristotle, you know, you get people saying women kind of suck. Men should just have friendships with men.
Even Brigham Young felt that way.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a different sort of barrier, though. I think, I mean, what this does is it provides a backdrop against which today's weird dynamic gets acted out against. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have celibate priestly orders in LDS belief. We don't have the exact same framework, but we've adopted a lot of the same ideas.
Well, and if we go back just a few centuries, we have men and women and their courting rituals were complex, but usually they were chaperoned. If men and women were left alone together, it was because it was for marriage. Men and women were often segregated. And even in Victorian times, men and women were not trusted to be alone. So they had chaperones. So it's not like men and women had a lot of opportunities.
Interactions.
To become friends. Yeah.
So it's not like we're working with a good framework here to begin with. I feel like society is changing and men and women are, you know, being thrown into the workplace together, and all of a sudden the rules have changed. And so now men and women have to learn how to deal with each other.
Well, men and women have a lot more in common now than they used to. I mean, women are actually women have higher graduation rates from college than men do now. So women are equally, if not greater, educated. So they are now able to converse with men about all the things that men have been talking about for hundreds of years, thousands of years.
Like football and trucks, right?
Could be an interest of women, modern women, too.
Well, who doesn't like football and trucks?
I do.
And men are more involved in the domestic duties than they used to be.
That's true. Let's talk about how this factors into our LDS culture. I just want to kind of bring up LDS dating rituals. who wants to start there on, for those who are non-Mormon or have never been Mormon, who might not understand our strange rules and rituals? First of all, we have the golden age to date, which is 16.
Right. Magic number.
Well, anyone else?
And then there's this complex, so let's talk about LDS dating rituals. To begin with, there's the magic ages, right? But then there's like this complicated multi-stage process of, you know, at 16 you start going on dates in certain group dates. At 18 you may start doing other things. All of it's lined up to send off young men on a mission at age 19 without having slept with their girlfriend. So people who are dating 19-year-old or, you know, 18, 19-year-old boys are encouraged to break it up in a lot of ways, to not form strong relationships. And then, of course, you're suddenly supposed to completely flip the switch when the person's 21, and you're supposed to date with, you know, an eye to marrying them in the next 3 months.
Have you guys heard the story of not some couples, their first kiss was over the altar in the temple?
Oh. Let it not be so.
I actually know of someone.
Oh, man. Well, when I was a teenager, it was not encouraged. I wasn't encouraged to become friends with boys at all. In fact, I think I was discouraged. I did have male friends, but like in the case of my gay friend, Nate, who I didn't know was gay at the time, but he was my friend, his parents would not allow girls to go into his bedroom, which would be a private place to talk and so on. I'm not saying there was any so ons, but the funny thing was that, yeah, he was gay, you know, and so he had boys in his bedroom.
Like in primary, I remember playing with my little neighbor boy until we got a little bit older. And then all of a sudden that stopped and the girls played with girls and boys played with boys. And I understand part of that society, but if you look in our youth program, primary is combined until they turn 12, till they hit puberty. And then we segregate the girls and the boys.
It's so creepy.
Right.
Yeah. And there was just a conversation going on in the FMH Facebook group about somebody who had posted about how proud she was to have not kissed more boys than she could count on one hand. Did you see that one? It was kind of no. fascinating.
Hmm.
And about how she shouldn't be sharing her cookies with lots of boys.
Oh, let's not go in those directions.
Which is awesome, because I'm like, who likes somebody who has a bunch of cookies and refuses to share them with their friends? Like, that person sucks.
It's not like there's only 10 cookies in your cupboard.
Yes,
did you guys ever get that dollar bill lesson? Like, they would bring out in your youth groups a crisp, green, fresh $1 bill. And they said, like, this is your first kiss, and you can only give it to one person. You can only spend this on one person. And one of our young women leaders, like, framed a dollar bill for all of us.
Oh, man.
Aww.
I tuned that
did
out.
You spend
I'd
it?
Take it out and spend it.
I think
it.
We did. I think we ended up spending it on, like, Wink Pops or something. But, well, yeah, so there's not a lot of encouragement for, I would say, healthy male-female interaction at that age. It's more fear-based.
Yeah, well, they do encourage girls and boys to get together. Like, isn't it age 14 that you're allowed to go to the church dances? And you are encouraged to, you know, to interact with the opposite sex. But it's always in sort of a romantic way. They never encouraged just regular friendship. It was always put in this frame mindset that these are romantic potentials.
You would have maybe combined youth activities where the men and the women would be combined, but it will always be chaperoned with tons of leaders, you know, so it's not like, and men and, or girls and boys were never allowed to spend the night unless it was maybe a youth conference. But then even then I've heard of stakes that nixed that.
Well, and so, yeah, and let's talk about, I mean, there's the dating, but then there's the big sort of formative life event for LDS young people, at least LDS young men, is the mission, right? And the mission is incredibly gender segregated. You are a bunch of 19-year-old boys who are to hang out with other 19-year-old boys. You are not to go near women. You are not to talk to, well, I mean, you talk to them in a very formal context. You are not to ever be, like, in the same room as a woman without chaperones who are making sure that you're not jumping into bed with her.
Right. Don't be in a car alone with a member of the opposite sex.
Yeah. And for a lot...
What do you do, Kaimi, if your mission companion is gay? How does that work?
Oh, my gosh. So... That's a really good question. I think there's, well, among young LDS men, there's a substantial degree of homophobia. And so it's not even a gay mission companion. It's like if any mission companion does not check off all of the boxes of the masculinity script perfectly, so you have a mission companion who has a little bit of a high-sounding voice, or, you know, who likes opera more than basketball or whatever else, then everybody starts saying, is Elder so-and-so gay? You better watch out. He's going to try to kiss you when you're asleep. All of these sort of, like, awful stories. And then, you know, then they'll start telling stories. I heard there was a missionary in the mission 2 years ago who woke up and his companion was trying to kiss him, and they had to send his companion home. And, yeah, it's all of these crazy homophobic discussions. But, I mean, it drives home the fact that part of the reason for homophobia in the church is the policing of this artificial romantic dating boundaries that we set up.
You know, that reminds me a lot of when I was like probably 10 or 11, I had my best friend was a boy, and I got teased for that so often, like, well, you're probably going to be kissing him in the trees and no one's looking. It's the exact same sort of like panic, paranoia, you know, being unable to see that relationship as anything other than potentially romantic for people from the outside.
Well, and I remember I wasn't allowed to go to boy-girl parties until I turned 14.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Which is kind of odd when you think about it. I mean, 14 is when you would start being more interested in someone from the opposite sex in that way, not as an 8-year-old. But that's what I'm saying. Like, this is problematic because for the gay and lesbian, you know, saints, are they not allowed to sleep in the same room at a young woman's sleepover or in the girls' camp tent?
Well,
if they're are we talking? I know that a lot of LDS people still don't believe that people are born gay, and maybe that's part of it. But I think that if this is about sexuality that we're afraid of, something is kind of inconsistent here.
Right.
Sure.
I think they just don't want to think about that possibility.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why they deny that it even exists as an option. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the goal is to segregate people off from all potential romantic partners until they arrive at a perfect match and then to have that match be their only contact, then you have to deny the possibility that the other boys that they're hanging out or the other girls they're hanging out with, if they're a girl, are people who they might be interested in romantically.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, one thing which we've mentioned before in discussions is the whole idea that people should be blocked off from any potential romantic contact. If a person is bisexual, that means you have to put them in a bubble forever. I mean, if you're taking the idea to its logical conclusion.
Well, I would say throughout the church, it's not only dating. So let's say a couple goes through these prescribed patterns and they get married. Now they're a married couple. And I felt like when I was married, my social interaction became extremely limited. Like, I remember I was friends with a lot of boys. I grew up with a lot of boys in the neighborhood. And I remember people telling me specifically, all right, you're going to have to find some friends that are girls now. Can't be friends with guys anymore. And I was like, but they're my friends, you know? But when you're married, it's like, you know, that scripture, you cleave unto your spouse and none else. And I think that a lot of Mormons take that as like you cut off everybody and you only hang out if they're couples because couples are safe.
Right. Well, and that just underscores, I mean, what this is all showing is that we have an impoverished discursive norm when we talk about how men and women interact in the church, right? I mean, Judith Butler, writing on, queer theorist Judith Butler, writes about how people perform gender rituals. That is, you do certain things and people look at you performing the script and they say that person is acting like a man because they're doing certain stuff that we've defined as stuff that men do. And so men do certain things and women do certain things, but there's not a lot of overlap in the church context. I mean, men are supposed to go earn the bread, you know, sweat their brow, come home and, you know, kiss their wife. Women are supposed to stay home, tend the baby, sweep the floor, clean the baseboards, and kiss the husband. I mean, the only overlap comes in the I guess there are a few other areas of overlap, but the major overlap comes in the context of men and women make out with each other. You know, they kiss each other, they have sex with each other, but they don't do other stuff. There isn't a lot of other overlap. They mm-hmm. make babies, exactly.
And they have family home evening together.
They have family home evening, and they sit together during sacrament meeting.
Well, Amy and I were talking about this because my husband's family is very old school patriarchal. And so when they get together as a family, literally the men go off in one room and they talk about men things like guns and trucks and four wheelers. And the women go off in the other room and they're usually in charge of the kids and they talk about, you know, the homemaking and their kids and that kind of thing. And when I first came into the family, first of all, I didn't have kids, so I didn't fit into that. Hmm. And I was used to, you know, lively discourse amongst my family. So I stayed with my husband and they would look at me like, what are you doing here? You're an outsider. And if I tried to, you know, engage in conversation about guns or trucks or four wheelers, my opinion was completely disregarded. And I've noticed that in his family, that it's very segregated. And so we were talking about that, how, you know, that carries over in church. That, like, if you're at, like, a ward party, the men have things to talk about and the women have things to talk about. You very, very rarely see a man and a woman who are not married talking about something that's not pretty much in a safe script. Now, the only time that you do see men and women talking together openly would probably be in Sunday school, but then they're talking about religious things.
Yeah, we have no script, I mean, for male-female interactions. So this is why it doesn't seem natural in the LDS context, with a few exceptions that we'll get to in a second. But I mean, look at the social events that you do in an LDS community, and you can just look at them and start gendering them. You know, the baby shower, who goes to the baby shower? The book group, who goes to the book group? The basketball game, who goes to the basketball game? These are gendered social events. And so we get the sort of script where we interact with people of our own gender, and we don't have, not that it can't be done, but we don't have an easy script to fall back on when we're interacting with somebody across gender lines outside of a few narrow contexts.
Well, it doesn't help, though, that we get talks from our leaders. There's that famous Dalnate Chokes talk. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. I mean, so Dallin H. Oakes famously says, like, don't hang out. You know, don't have this sort of friendly interaction of hanging out with somebody who might be a romantic partner. Get romantic with them. You know, go on dates. Do the interact the script of romantic coupling or of dating coupling rather than the script of simply friendship. You know what? Can I just read a couple things? I just pulled up this talk, right?
Give us the name of the talk.
The name of the talk is The Dedication of a Lifetime. It's a CES fireside for young adults, which was widely cited. I think he said more of this in conference too. This is just what I pulled up quickly. So here's a couple of direct quotes. He says, observers report that dating has nearly disappeared from college campuses and young adults generally. It has been replaced by something called hanging out.
Oh, no.
And then he continues in a sentence later, hanging out consists of numbers of young men and young women joining together in some group activity. It's very different from dating. And then he skips a line. He says, unlike hanging out, dating is not a team sport. Dating is pairing off to experience the kind of one-on-one association and temporary commitment that can lead to marriage. Ooh.
I remember hearing, when was this talk given? Do you have a date on that?
I remember this too.
This 05? Yeah, 2005.
I remember being completely confused by this. Like wanting to do what he said because he was an apostle. But thinking, okay, so do you want me to pair off or do you not want me to pair off? It was really confusing.
This is the Mormon lore I heard at the time was that everyone at BYU wasn't single dating enough.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
And that they needed to, that they were getting together in these big groups and that they needed to start getting serious. And the pressure was put on the boys, as I recall.
Right. Naughtiness.
Well, because men are the ones asking women to get married.
Right.
Not enough men were getting married, and they were falling away from the church as a result.
They were doing that sinful thing called hanging out.
And he says this, like he says, young men, you know, we get, quote, this is men after you've returned from your mission, blah, blah, blah. He says, quote, it's marriage time.
It's marriage time.
Zilpha, will you put that on a t-shirt, please? I'll buy it.
Yeah.
But what's funny is
what's that talk that young men are a menace to society?
Well, that's, Brigham Young from, you know, where he says large numbers of unmarried young men over 25 are a menace to society.
Maybe because there was no women for those men to marry, Brigham.
Hide your wife, hide your kids.
Right. Brigham's marrying everybody in Utah, baby.
But the funny thing is that they encourage young men to not get close to young women before their mission, and then, like you guys said, all of a sudden, right after their mission, they have to get married. But they never had really practice in forming close, intimate relationships with women.
Right.
Oh, I had a young women's instructor tell us semi-jokingly not to waste our time on pre-missionaries when we went to college.
Right. Well, Spencer Kimball. And way back in 76, but this was in a young women's manual, he said young people should still limit the close contacts for several years, since the boy will be going on his mission when he's 19 years old. So limit the close contacts with the opposite sex.
And of course, there's the weirdness of women's mission ages, which seem calculated not to send women on missions, but to result in a pool of, you know, marriageable 18, 19, 20-year-old women for those 21-year-old men to date and marry and have babies with.
To scoop up. And also, going along with what we're saying, men and women of the same ages certainly can't be around each other without falling romantically in love. So they have to have the women older than the men when they're all out there on their missions together, so that hopefully the men won't be interested sexually. It doesn't work.
And an old crone who's 2 years older than them.
What is the function
of all of this in the church? Is it just to preserve virginity?
Yes.
Is there any other function that anyone can think of?
I think it's become cultural too, though. I mean, I think it started off rooted in a very, you know, 18th century, 19th century type attitudes of men and women can't be alone. Because then again, if we go back, men and women stopped working together in the fields and started becoming more segregated and were only brought together for courtship. And there was a major distrust of women's sexuality in particular. And, you know, men were allowed to interact with women, but those women had, tainted virtue. If right. a woman was seen without her chaperone, she was tainted. So I think that, you know, it started rooted in that culture, and we've just kind of carried it on. But since we are in a patriarchy, there is a huge fear of women's sexuality in the patriarchy. You just can't get around that.
Yeah, and let's not be too classist. And, you know, we need to recognize that for women who are not upper class, for a majority of women, for African-American women, for other, you know, non-white women, I mean, these kind of segregated gender roles were often not an option. I mean, it's not that, you know, the poor women living in poorer neighborhoods did not have chaperones because it was simply, you know, not affordable, you know, just like, you know, they couldn't get a room of one's own, like Virginia Woolf says. I mean, to some extent, this whole script is based around an idea of a middle class or upper class cultural setting. But yeah, it's a script that we've absolutely adopted in some ways and modified in some ways.
Well, and, you know, if you look at some Islamic cultures centuries and centuries ago, they've had these exact kind of very segregated men and women's gender roles. And interactions are, in some cases, men would not see their bride until the wedding day. And I think a lot of it does come from the fear of, like Malia said, virginity and sexuality and that kind of thing, which results in a patriarchy.
Well, and of course, there's, you know, until very recently, birth control was not an option in a lot of instances. So there's the possibility that if one's, you know, you could end up with Mary, right, who is unmarried but pregnant, and then it's a scandal. You know, of course, she's pregnant because of God. But yeah, this was a significant fear.
Well, let's bring it back modern day.
Yeah.
We've got this great quote from President Benson from the New Era, 1988. It was given at a BYU devotional. And he says, if you are married, avoid flirtations of any kind. Sometimes we hear of a married man going to lunch with a secretary or other women in the office. Men and women who are married sometimes flirt and tease with members of the opposite sex. So-called harmless meetings are arranged, or inordinate amounts of time are spent together. In all of these cases, people rationalize by saying that these are natural expressions of friendship. But what may appear to be harmless teasing or simply having a little fun with someone of the opposite sex can easily be led to more serious involvement and eventual infidelity.
That is so backward. I don't even know where to start.
Well, let's start with this. When I have this discussion with, you know, with some of the women on our Feminist Mormon Housewives Facebook group, it becomes a sensitive topic. You know, I want to be dismissive and be like, oh, the church is being so paranoid. But then you have women that say, hey, listen, I cheated on my spouse, or my spouse cheated on me because of an office flirtation. So I don't mean to dismiss these situations. Do they happen? Absolutely they do. Do people have affairs every single day? And I don't think that that's what we're trying to say. We're trying to express why it's so hard for men and women to interact. Do you guys agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why President Benson said this, is because it happens. I mean, if you're sexually attracted to someone, which, you know, the majority of attractions are between men and women, then it's hard to be with someone a lot and flirt and tease with someone that you're sexually attracted to and they're sexually attracted to you without, you know, it being sort of sexually exciting.
Well, I think the problem that I find in his quote is he gives you the slippery slope argument, you know, like, It's suggestive that if a man and a woman are alone together, eventual inevitability is that they're going to sleep together.
Right.
And, you know, I've had conversations with people that say the same thing. Well, you just never know. You never know what could happen if you let your guard down. And I would be really interested to know what the probability is of a man and a woman being alone in a room for the first time, just caught up in the heat of the moment, ripping off their clothes and having an affair. I would wonder if that was very common at all.
No, but I think if you were spending a lot of time with someone, and you were both sexually attracted to each other. I think that's the wild card, is that there is sexual attraction that can happen between members, you know, if you're heterosexual, between members of the opposite sex. And how, I mean, not that you're going to do something the first time or the second time or the third time that you're alone together, but I think I do understand where President Benson is coming from, where his concern is, because it can lead to infidelity.
Well, you just brought up an interesting question in my mind, Zilpha. You're saying, like, if you're sexually attracted to someone, what if you were not, absolutely not sexually attracted to someone of the opposite sex, and you were in the same room? Like, do you believe that sometimes, do any of you guys believe that sometimes, even if there's no initial attraction, that you can form that?
I mean, it's possible, but it probably would be less risky of a relationship.
Well, to go back to what we were talking about before, I feel like because the church doesn't prepare members to deal with sexual attraction, which is going to happen, you're going to feel that for other people beside your husband or your wife throughout the rest of your life. Most people will feel that in one way or another. And the church doesn't really prepare, I feel, its members to deal with that. They just say, well, you know, pay attention to your husband, pay attention to your wife. Well, that's not always necessarily realistic. I feel like there needs to be some sort of acknowledgement of, yeah, you're going to probably feel that way again in your life. You know, it's not bad.
The church does not prepare men and women to be alone. And that's why, you know,
to deal with sexual attraction.
Yeah. And like, I know of many, many, many women who cannot even contemplate the idea that their husband might find another woman attractive. Like, I remember sitting in a room with a couple and a Victoria's Secret commercial came on and she kept looking at him to see if he was watching the commercial. And of course we were all watching because it was on the TV. And when he did, she would like slap him in the stomach, you know, and be like, geez, you're such a pervert. Why are you watching that? Well, because it's on TV. We're all watching it. And I think that attitude, I think it goes both ways. We really want to think that our spouse, like that we are the only attractive person in our spouse's eyes. And that's just not like biologically possible.
Agreed.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But in the church, when you have this idea of that scripture, gosh, I wish I could think of it. Amy, can you think of it? Having an eye single to...
I know. Wait, cleave unto spouse?
No, it's about God. And then, and I've heard it related, like, you know, Christ, as Christ loved the church, that's how you love your wife.
Oh, yeah, that's Ephesians. Husbands, love your wife like Christ loved the church. Mm-hmm. Let me pull that one up.
I might be mingling my scriptures with the philosophies of man here, but...
Yeah, so that's Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. So, yeah, I mean, that you're supposed to have a divine level of love for your spouse, absolutely. Your love for your spouse is supposed to be Jesus-like.
So would the sin in the church be the initial sin being attracted to someone else? Like if you're in the workplace and you're married and you find your coworker attractive, is that where the sin begins in the church's eyes?
Yeah, because then you're lusting after a woman in your heart. That scripture, wherever it is.
I think President Kimball would say so.
What do you guys all think about that? Do you think that's unrealistic? Do you think that that's like a realistic expectation to...
No. It's sort of like masturbation. It's one of those things that you just you can't completely get rid of if you're a sexual being, which most of us are.
So that's why the church's approach is problematic.
Right. And you can see like that's the underlying reason for building a firewall is sort of a recognition, I think, that sexual beings will be attracted to other people, and therefore the solution is quarantine. Women are smallpox.
And avoid even the...
Talk about t-shirts. Women are smallpox. Yes.
Even the appearance of evil is to be avoided. So if you go out to lunch with a coworker of the opposite sex, that is a big no-no.
I'm trying to think, isn't there a quote from, I want to say Benson or Kimball, talking about how since women, you know, women going into the workplace is destroying the family because it's basically tempting the men. It's giving men more opportunities to lust after these lustful women because the women come to work and they're all nice and fancy and then they go home to their frumpy wife. Of course, I'm elaborating, I think, on what was said, but I have heard, I sat in on a Stake Relief Society panel once where we could, it was like a question and answer and we could ask the Stake Relief Society president questions. And a lot of the questions were like, well, how do you keep your, how do you compete with the women in your husband's workplace? And there was a lot of advice like, well, those women bring their A game into the office. So you guys need to do your hair and spray some perfume when your husband comes home because that's what he's seeing all day.
Well, and there's, I mean, President Benson did say, direct quote here, numerous divorces can be traced directly to the day when the wife left the home and went out into the world into employment.
Well, and he's right, but not for those reasons. I mean, divorces do increase the more that a woman works, but there's a plethora of other reasons, some of them good.
Like abusive husbands, yes. And the woman can finally
support herself.
Yes.
Or more likely, she's just a trollop that's attracting men at work.
I think that goes on the t-shirt, too.
Write them down, people. These are gold. I don't think any of us are saying that work affairs don't happen. Because they do. And the thing is, affairs absolutely happen outside of the church, too. And I think that's because society is still learning these new scripts. You know, men and women, just within the last 50 years, have been kind of thrown into the workplace more and more and more. And the internet also opens up constant interaction. I can talk to a male stranger in China.
And she does a lot.
And I do. And, you know, my husband would never know about it. It's very easy to interact male and female. And so I think it's like a brave new world for all of us. I was just going to talk about the current approach in the church and why, you know, it's not necessarily working, you know, and this is a problem that I find with the modern church a lot. Most often their intentions are good, but their approach actually is problematic. Like with pornography, we see they don't want people to become addicted to it. And their approach actually drives more addiction than it takes it away. I'm not saying that the church forced people into affairs, but when there's such a fear-based rhetoric about people of the opposite gender, it's like you get thrown into the situation with someone from the opposite sex and all of a sudden you don't know what to do. And so you don't really have any tools in your toolbox to help you navigate these waters, except for avoid, which is impossible now.
So when you look at all of the talks, like where he says, literally, he says, avoid being alone with members of the opposite sex wherever possible. I mean, I think this primes people because it puts if it's like you're telling a child, don't think about eating the chocolate cake, don't think about eating the chocolate cake, don't think about eating the chocolate cake, you know, the child is going to think about eating the
chocolate cake. I want
chocolate
cake right now.
Exactly. So, like, it seems like sometimes the level of emphasis that's placed on the topic may actually, I don't know, but empirically it seems like it could be counterproductive to have this barrage of messages, stay away from the dangerous women who are going to try to jump into bed with you.
Well, and I just feel like in what I've seen, and Zilpha, I don't know if you felt this way in your words, but it's brought a lot of anxiety towards women. You know, they're so worried that if their husband is talking to someone else, that it somehow reflects on them or what they're not doing. And they feel like they have to keep their guard up and the pressure's on. And it's just this endless circle of anxiety and mistrust of their husbands. Instead of fostering this trust within the relationship, I think we often foster such distrust. Oh, your husband's going to look at porn. Oh, he's going to cheat on you. And vice versa. I'm not a man, so I haven't gotten the rhetoric there, but I do know that there is a lot of distrust in the relationship that's being fostered with these kind of attitudes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really remember actually feeling that in my relationship, because John and I were sort of attached at the hip, I guess. I mean, we really didn't venture out past our marriage. That's how afraid we were. So we weren't, except for in our callings and in our families, we really didn't have any other relationships to speak of.
So it was never like an issue you had to worry about?
No, I mean, we took it pretty much to the extreme and we just avoided everybody else.
When was the first time that you guys started becoming, like, broadening your friendship circles and becoming friends with people of the opposite gender.
After we left the church, through post-Mormon groups. That was the first
time. It is pretty impossible. I would agree. Like, I think it was hard to be myself to be friends with boys in the church. And now that I'm not really in it, my husband and I have a really wide group of friends. And sometimes he hangs out with girls. Sometimes I hang out with boys.
I remember Malia's my friend from growing up, and my husband and I were still doing like those scripted. We would invite couples over for dinner, and we still do that. But, you know, we never crossed any boundaries. We followed the rules there. And I would hear about Malia and her husband and having one of the couple come over, or she would be alone for a time in the house with him. And I remember thinking, uh-oh, that's not good.
It was so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange because for John and I, he sort of relates to women better than he relates to men in a lot of ways. And I'm the opposite. I relate to men better than I relate to women in a lot of ways. So since relaxing that position on, oh, we can't be friends with people of the opposite sex, we've really been able to cultivate some meaningful relationships and friendships that we weren't able to before.
Well, I remember getting, we had probably about 2 years ago, the stake president came to our ward and he held a special Sunday school for the men and the women. And he brought us in, and the whole Sunday school focus was on the dangers of Facebook and how Facebook was causing all of these affairs. And he was like, oh, brothers and sisters, you don't know how many marriages in the stake have ended because of Facebook, because people will reconnect and they'll talk. And some of the greatest blessings for me with Facebook is reconnecting with people, men and women. And that's how I look at it. And I've met so many wonderful friends. I do think that when a man and a woman do form a bond, a friendship, like a true friendship, not just an acquaintance, sometimes they have to confront the sexual aspect of it.
I absolutely agree.
I think like a man and a woman have to confront it and say, okay, what does this mean? Like, what am I feeling? What do we want from this? And then you set your boundaries and you move on.
Not necessarily together, right? You mean...
Yeah, I don't think you have to have the talk.
Because that would be slightly awkward.
I think you can have the talk. You have a
DTR talk.
Yeah.
Is it okay if I went to sleep with you, but we still remain friends?
It might be a healthy conversation to have sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? There's no script for this, and these kind of scripts need to be created. I think that I'm pretty open and upfront, and so I'm always... you know, having these discussions with people.
She's always shooting down married guys.
Oh, you know it. No, but...
me too. Married guys are always after.
Well, Kami, you were bringing up some really interesting things, though, and why the current approach in the church hurts women more than men.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a minute, right? I mean, so a firewall is going to have different effects on different groups. And in particular, in the workplace, it's incredibly important to network. I mean, I'm particularly familiar with the workplace in law and academia just because that's where I'm at. But every workplace that I've seen, it's incredibly important to network. So you need to do stuff. You need to go out to lunch with senior colleagues and talk about, you know, how to teach a class or how to put together a brief. Or how to, what's the deal with this partner at the law firm? Does he hate you? No, he yells at everybody. Oh, okay, I don't need to worry. But like, you need to have these informal conversations, and there may be different contexts for it. A lot of folks at the law firm might go out for golfing, or, you know, they might go out for drinks or whatever it is. But there's these informal networking opportunities. If we, just because of the way that jobs have been allocated in society up to this point, I mean, the majority, something like 85% of law partners are male, a majority of senior faculty, a majority of senior people in whatever field you're in, accounting or teaching or whatever else, are likely to be male. And so if we're suddenly saying we're not allowed to have that sort of interaction, what we're going to be doing is limiting women's abilities to have workplace interactions that help them advance as a person in that workplace.
Well, and I feel like we're only like utilizing, when we do that, we're only utilizing half of the workforce ideas. I mean, if men are only allowed to work with men, then they're going to come up with the same kind of performed rituals that you were talking about consistently over and over, you know, many different versions of that, and women would do the same thing. And it's just limiting your idea pool and your creativity by half. Yeah,
absolutely. And not only that, two sort of follow-ups on that point. The first is, it's going to be limiting your idea pool in specific ways. I mean, to the extent men and women are socialized to think differently, women are going to be able to see problems that men don't see, and vice versa. And not only that, there's this great study from the Harvard Business Review about how group decision-making increases as you add women to the group. Real study, it's awesome. Showing, yeah, that group decision-making, the best way to increase the quality of group decision-making is to add women to the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't do that.
This is a really great point about limiting women's career growth opportunities if they're not encouraged to attend lunches with their male partners, and especially the men who are, you know, their supervisors and above them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really detrimental.
Yeah, there's a great quote from Sheila from Feminist Mormon Housewives where she says, and I'll just read her quote, she says, "I feel my life experience isn't as fully rounded as it could be without male friendships as part of my life. I also understand that platonic friendships don't always stay platonic, but as an LDS stay-at-home mom, sometimes I wonder if I'm nearly as cloistered within feminine domestic space as I would be if physical walls separated me from men."
So, and I've seen that. Have you guys ever been like to a playgroup where there's like a stay-at-home dad that comes to the playgroup? This is still kind of rare in the LDS circles that I run in. But when you have the rare occasion to have like a stay-at-home dad come to the McDonald's playland, it's like there's like shock and awe. Like, oh my gosh, there's a man here, and then every, you know, all the women are excited and eager to talk to him. But at the same time, there's also that fear and that caution, like, oh, we can't get too close. And you can't talk to him in the way that you talk to another woman at the group, mm-hmm. even though our experiences are virtually the same as stay-at-home parents.
So, and of course, it goes in tandem with the idea that women are walking porn, who are walking around using their womanly bodies in tempting ways to tempt all of the men with whom they interact.
And men can't control themselves. They're these sexual beasts just waiting to be unleashed. You know, they just need one spark and then they're all over the place sexually. And that's what we still continue to get and hear in the priesthood sessions and in conference. And, you know, I've heard tell that it's backing down a little bit, but I think that it goes hand in hand with the pornography and the modesty rhetoric. The idea that women are the gatekeepers of men's virtue is so messed up on so many levels. But this is one of them that's problematic. If a woman's a gatekeeper, that suggests that a man can't be a gatekeeper for his own virtue.
Well, there's kind of the idea that, like, which I don't understand, that there'll be this uncontrollable urge and all of a sudden you'll start, you know, like, I know we've joked about it, but like ripping your clothes off. You know, if you feel attraction for someone, sexual contact is inevitable if you aren't chaperoned completely for the rest of your lives.
Yeah. And, you know, and women as gatekeepers, which of course puts the blame for anything that occurs on women, because they should have been better gatekeepers and more careful with keeping guys out of their gate.
Well, they are.
What do you mean by that? No, I'm just kidding.
You know, they are seen as gatekeepers, but like you said, the men are seen as predators. So whatever happens, they're both blamed because something is wrong with mm-hmm. people getting together sexually if they're not married. But it's pretty like natural.
What we talked about.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's a pretty natural thing to have happen. So I don't know, how do you keep it just on a friendship level if you're attracted to someone that you're friends with but you're not married to?
Well, and to mention, I mean, society as a whole sort of has this idea too, right? Like every show in the world, you know, When Harry Met Sally, or like every single cop show or sitcom or whatever, are they going to get together? Of course they're going to get together. Cute boy, cute girl in the same show, you know, by season 3 they're going to hook up.
Or you hope they will.
Definitely.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you ask how we can have healthy interactions. I think it starts with stop seeing everyone as a potential sex partner. I mean, I honestly do not go through life that way. I don't see every single man as a sex partner. Maybe people do that. Maybe, I don't know, I'm abnormal. But I don't, like I said when we talked about earlier, Zilpha, do you think if you're not sexually attracted to someone that you're, you know, that you're going to end up having an affair with them?
No, it's the sexual attraction that gets in the way sometimes, I think.
Exactly. And I think that that's when the boundaries need to come in.
Yeah, this is the famous line from Harry Met Sally, right? Should we say that one? No.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm pulling it up here. So, yeah, Harry says that men and women can never be friends. No, that's the other part. No,
oh, he says, okay, sorry. I was never confused.
Friends, yeah, because the sex part always gets in the way. No, this is not the fake orgasm. That's another part. So here we go. I'm reading straight from IMDb. Harry says, no man can be friends with a woman he finds attractive. He always wants to have sex with her.
So isn't that true in a way? I mean, isn't that sort of the definition of being attracted to someone sexually attracted to someone that you would potentially like to have sex with them?
Well, my response to that is, so what? I mean, does that mean you can't be friends?
No.
Even if a man wants to have sex with you, I'd be flattered.
Right. So is it possible to want to have sex with someone and spend a lot of time with that person without actually having sex with them?
I think yes, but I think we need to start having healthier discussions. I think, it's just my personal opinion, and I'm no expert, but if we started off with healthier sex rhetoric in the church and body rhetoric, if we weren't so fear-based about sexuality and our bodies growing up, maybe we'd have healthier ideas of how to interact. You know, I'm not sure on that, but, you know, I do know this. Fear and shame do not foster anything good
and
lasting. They foster secretive behavior. They foster guilty thoughts. So I think that, first of all, if men and women started looking at sexuality as like a healthy thing, and I'm not saying as like a free-for-all, but like if they were able to embrace their own sexuality and not be ashamed of it, maybe they could, I don't know.
So like, understand. Say I have this friend, I'm sexually attracted to him, and that's okay. I'm not going to act on that sexual attraction, but it's there and I acknowledge it. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I think she's saying. My own personal belief, if we did something like, because I know it wouldn't happen since it's the Boy Scouts, but if we had our youth working together in something like the Boy Scouts, learning how to work together with the opposite sex, learning how to cooperate, you know,
at a young age.
Yeah, at a young age, I really think that we'd avoid a whole lot of the problems that we're seeing
right
now, is people don't know how to work together.
Right, because all of our interactions were sort of framed as those are the boys, those are the girls. When they get together, romantic things happen.
Right. But if we taught them, hey, we need to build a campfire together, you five go and, you know, figure out what sticks we need. Like, I really feel like that would give people something to work from when they enter the workplace together, because, I mean, that's the reality of where things are going. It's not going to end as far as more women going into the workplace anytime soon, at least. You know, it would be, I think it would give them a little more of a fighting chance on a healthy relationship with someone of the opposite sex that they happen to be attracted to in some cases.
And I think people could learn their own boundaries and their own triggers, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Just naturally something else that I think, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I feel like men and women need to be more open and honest with their spouse.
Yes.
And maybe that's just like a personal preference, but people know this about me. I'm very open with my spouse, and that's a benefit. He knows who I'm talking to, and he doesn't ask. I tell him. And if I feel like it's crossing a line, I will tell him.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's a really healthy thing, because I think when it becomes secretive, that can become problematic.
Right, because the secret itself can be intoxicating and sexually arousing. So if you have a relationship with someone of the opposite sex, even if you're attracted to them, but you're open about it with your spouse, it sort of deflates some of the excitement of the other relationship. I've found that. Well, I'm like you, Lindsay. I tell John everything. I tell John who I'm talking to, and I have found that, like, sometimes I'm sort of getting excited by a different relationship, and I'll tell John about it, and it sort of deflates the idea of that fantasy relationship.
Well, and I think it's normal that to be excited by new relationships. Whenever I have form a new relationship, it is exciting because it's new opinions and new thoughts and new activities and new behavior coming into my life, and that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And rather than being scared of it, I kind of work through it and think, okay, what does this mean? And sometimes you go through that period of like, oh, I really like this person. Mm-hmm. And I think it fades. I think it fades once you can put it into perspective. But if you keep feeding it with secrecy,
right,
and shame, that doesn't help. But what that would take is, you know, Zilpha, if you told John, listen, you know, I met this really cool guy and we've been talking and we just have a lot in common, and John freaked out on you and said, that's it. You're never talking to him again, and I'm cutting off your cell phone.
Yeah, that's true. You know? It has to go both ways, and there has to be respect on both sides and allowance for friends. I have to allow John to have friends if I want to have friends.
And not be suspicious of our spouse's sexuality. Like, my husband sometimes has to go on long drives with sometimes attractive women, sometimes not women that I would find attractive, but sometimes attractive women. And I trust him. And I look at it this way. If he was going to do something, I wouldn't know about it anyway. I can't control that. I can't control that.
You can't control him. I mean, he's a totally separate person. Like,
yeah,
I think that's part of it is to stop seeing your spouse as an extension of you and as a separate individual instead.
Yeah, I like that. That just sounds too healthy.
Can we talk for a bit about the couples culture in Mormon culture, about how couples seem to interact with one another almost exclusively and what that means?
Yeah, like John and I were
single, like, people,
right?
Like through their shared couple email and their shared couple Facebook account.
Yes.
Yeah, you marry your Facebook. That's quite common.
Yeah.
And then like the one spouse writes in all caps and then one writes in lowercase.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, that's how you tell them.
I haven't seen that. That's great. What?
John's parents, you can't tell who they are because they don't, unless they say this is, you know, so-and-so. It's just one account, one voice.
Well, I see. I get confused by those. I'm like, wait, Mike's into crafting on Pinterest? When did that happen? Oh, wait, it's his wife.
Right. I think that's part of the, like I was saying before with John and I, just being attached to the hip and being afraid to be anything but just seamed together on all sides.
Well, and my poor husband, if he, like, I interact with a lot of people online, especially through Feminist Born Housewives, so I get a lot of updates and emails because I moderate that group. My husband would kill himself if he had to be part of my Facebook and get those little buzzes on his phone all day. He couldn't care less about that stuff. He wants to be far away from it. And so he trusts me to behave like an adult and fulfill the promise of monogamy, I guess, that we said. And do people break that promise? Yeah, all the time. But like, you know, like I said before, you can't control that. There are safeguards you can put within yourself, I think. But I don't know if...
I think a lot of it has to do with your relationship, the communication that you have as a couple. If you're not getting sort of the conversation that you would like to be having from your spouse, and you get that somewhere else, that can be tempting. To just say, well, this primary relationship isn't.
It's the idea, though, that your spouse has to fulfill all of your needs, which is like virtually impossible.
No, they can't fulfill all your needs. But if it's not a satisfying relationship, people will more likely look elsewhere to satisfy their whatever, you know, they're longing for. And usually it's...
And in which case, it doesn't really matter if you have friends or not, in my opinion. You know, if you're that unsatisfied...
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Well,
so let's just talk about because I think some people would say, so you're saying that there are, whenever I have these conversations about anything and we bring up some negative or, you know, critical points or something, that they, you know, swing to the opposite side. So you're saying that men and women don't need any rules. They can just be friends. Or, and nothing will ever happen. I don't think any of us are saying that. If you find yourself in a situation where you are, I hate to use this word, tempted or feeling attracted to someone, what are some things you can do as safeguards, if we're going to use that word?
Sing a hymn. And our,
sing a prayer. Avoid, run away, do not. I mean, should you eat lunch with a coworker? Should you go to lunch with a coworker of the opposite sex?
That you're attracted to.
That you're attracted to. I would say, yes, that's acceptable. So long as you set some personal boundaries. Do you guys agree, disagree?
No, I agree. What kinds of personal boundaries would you set, Lindsay?
I think for me, again, if it becomes secretive, that's when it's problematic. So if you find yourself, you know, not being able to share something, maybe this is too fear shame or fear based, but like if you aren't able to share what you talked about with your spouse openly, not that your spouse needs to know every little detail of your conversation, but if you were to say something about your own relationship or complain about your own relationship, I think that that might be problematic. It would bother me to know that my husband was complaining to another woman that he was attracted to about my relationship.
Hmm.
What if he was complaining to a guy?
That would bother me too, actually. I want him to think I'm perfect. That's a good question. That's a really good question. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that. Mui, what do you think?
Well, I feel like I have a really lackadaisical point of view of it. And I do feel like it bears being said, I have not been cheated on by a boyfriend or my husband. So I haven't been in that position, at least that I know of. Definitely could have happened and I not know of it.
It's happening right now.
It's probably happening right now. But so I feel like if that had happened to me, I might have more of a visceral reaction toward that. So I do think that it's worth mentioning that, that I have not been in that position yet. And I don't think Lindsay has either. So maybe we would be a little more, what's the word?
Sensitive?
Yeah, sensitive toward it if that had happened.
What do you guys think? What would your answer be to that?
To the what boundaries?
No, Zilpha, okay, if you knew John were complaining, you know, to another woman about your marriage versus complaining to another man, are you equally as uncomfortable or...
Yeah, I mean, I actually, it wouldn't really bother me very much either way because he would tell me about it. So
the secrecy is part of the issue here.
Like if I found out later that he had secretly been complaining about me to someone like a lot, like the same person, it wouldn't matter if it was a man or a woman. I would think that was pretty odd. But I don't think that was like the path to infidelity or anything like that. I just think it was odd.
Okay, Amy, what do you think are some good boundaries for men and women that are attracted to each other but have to interact with each other or choose to?
That's a good question. We'll start with, I think we do have to have, it's the 21st century, we do have to have interactions with other people. You know, Jesus talked with girls, right? We're supposed to emulate Jesus. So we're supposed to talk with people. But yeah, sometimes friendship can evolve into romantic feelings. This is an understandable tendency. I mean, we develop connections with people with whom we interact. And of course, friendship and romance are not the same type of connections, but they can be linked, especially if we seek the same kind of attributes in a friend that we seek in a romantic partner.
Mm-hmm. So, and especially in the beginning, don't you think, guys? I mean,
when it's exciting. Starts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, interesting new person can be both be very interesting as a friend or interesting as a romantic connection. And if you don't have them, I mean, we live our lives in scripts. If you don't have somebody slotted into a script, then yeah, there's fluidity between these categories. So wait, what was the question?
Well, the boundaries. I think for boundaries, it seems like if you're married, you should probably talk to your spouse about what they feel comfortable with you doing with someone with the opposite sex.
Yeah, I agree.
Because that makes sense.
If they're okay with you walking around holding hands with your friend who's a guy, well, then it's not a problem if neither of you have a problem with it. It all depends on your primary relationship.
There's this great article on psychologytoday.com. It's I think it's titled "Can Men and Women Be Friends?" And you can look it up. And they talk about the different dynamics that men and women have. And they say that one of them is, since, you know, historically women have been more submissive and men have more power usually in the work sphere, often that brings some baggage. And so women are at risk of subconsciously adopting the more submissive friendship role in the friendship. And they said that that's, you know, part of the boundaries to make sure that you, if you decide that you're going to be a friend in the opposite sex, that it's an equal friendship, you know, that you stand on equal grounds, at least emotionally. But they, you know, they say that sometimes you need to be respectful of the fact that if you do work from home and your spouse doesn't, you have more opportunities to interact with people in general. And so you need to be sensitive that your spouse isn't getting those same opportunities.
You mean if you work outside of the home and your spouse is stuck at home?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of times...
You know, men get some more benefits from it because, you know, they feel like... This is from the Psychology Today article. They're just saying that men can feel like they can confide in women more than they can with their performed rituals with men, you know, because men aren't supposed to be sensitive and listen to those things. And that's changing a little bit. So men tend to share more with women, and women share the same with women and with men. Maybe set some boundaries on what you're comfortable sharing. Like, I would say it's probably not a good idea to badmouth your wife to someone you're sexually attracted to.
Yeah, and well, and that, so there was this conversation happening in the FMH group about types of connection and whether, and I think it's a bit overstated, but there may be something to it, about what is sort of more threatening, whether sexual attraction or whether emotional intimacy with somebody else is more threatening.
Emotional.
Yeah, because
I feel like physical, but I mean...
I'm going with emotional.
I think it depends.
It does depend. It seems like emotional intimacy is harder to achieve. And that is something that you've built up over time with your spouse. And it seems a little unfair to start investing a bunch of emotional intimacy into some new relationship or some relationship outside of your, I don't know. Like, emotional intimacy... Do you mean like level of sharing or level of feeling toward the other person? Because level of sharing doesn't bother me, but the amount of feeling that, like, if John had towards someone else, that would bother me. But not that he was sexually attracted to them, but that he cared about them deeply, like he cares about me.
I'm with you, Zilpha. That would bother me way more than him getting drunk and having sex one night.
Yeah.
Like,
well, see, but that's what I'm trying to say. It's hard to measure because, you know, we usually measure affairs when another spouse sleeps with someone else.
And, right, and but that's like, oh, well, I mean, not that I would really appreciate that unless I specifically gave him permission, but you know, it's just really not as big of a deal, and it's not as threatening, really, to the actual relationship, because sex one night... doesn't have anything to do with what you're doing day in, day out, and your relationship with that person, really.
Yes, I agree.
So boundaries about sharing, and maybe if you find yourself feeling a longing to be with that person, to replace your spouse with that person.
Yeah, I think that would be a warning sign.
In the article that I mentioned earlier, it says... Whatever the challenges of male-female friendship, researchers agree that to succeed as friends, both genders have to openly and honestly negotiate exactly what their relationship will mean, whether sexual attraction is a factor and how they'll deal with it, and establish boundaries. In some of the studies they did, the friendships that survived and even thrived after sex or attraction came into play were those in which the friends extensively discussed the meaning of sexual activity and felt confident of the sexual activity in the friendship and felt confident and positive about each other's feelings, Once they got past that, they were home free. If sex is part of the dynamic, addressing it explicitly is the best strategy for making sure the friendship survives.
That makes sense, because some of the enjoyment that comes from forming a new romantic relationship is the ambiguity of it all. Do they like you? Do you like them?
Well, and I see, like, in movies, you see this script of, like, a married man or a married woman, and they say, oh, you know, I can't, it's forbidden, I'm married, you know, but it's kind of half-heartedly. And then they take each other on the conference table. I feel like just saying, you know, I'm married isn't enough. You have to know your own boundary first. Like, you need to be honest with yourself. Are you looking to replace your spouse? And sometimes I think people are, even if they don't want to, and you need to be honest and address that. Am I trying to pursue this person? And I think that if you are, and you want your marriage to survive and you want to respect your partner, then you need to change course.
Right. But maybe it's a sign that it's, you know, that your marriage isn't working. And so then you need to either try to fix it or get divorced and move on. But don't hurt the person, you know, by getting this other relationship without actually addressing the problem, which is the primary relationship.
Exactly. I agree. Does anyone else feel like we need to cover any more boundaries? Have we covered boundaries enough?
I think so.
Well,
I have something that I was just thinking about. What would the church say? Would they say that there's not enough of a net gain to risk any of this in having a relationship? Like, what are we missing out on if we don't have a friendship with someone of the opposite sex?
Definitely, they would say that there's not enough of a net gain to make it worth it. Because,
well, I think that that's part of the reason why we have such inequality in the church, because we believe that men and women can't be trusted together. They certainly can't be trusted to work together. A male bishop can't have a first counselor that's a female, because they would spend long hours together.
And the emphasis on the eternal marriage and that covenant is so strong to try to make it seem like that's all you need. Like you were saying, Lindsay, you can't have all your needs fulfilled by one person, and you can't, but the church would have you think that you can and that you must.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it goes to something that Lindsay actually wrote on FMH a year ago, where Lindsay wrote, "We as human beings won't ever stop being attracted to people. Pretending like we aren't attracted to new individuals is just pretending. So what you have to do then is figure out what to do next, if that's what's happening, which involves figuring out all the boundaries that we've just been discussing."
So the question is, can LDS married men and women be friends?
They should.
They can be.
If we can act like grown-ups.
Yes.
Yes.
Can an LDS Relief Society president be alone in the church with a bishop, male bishop?
Hell yeah.
She's a lesbian. Yes.
Well, good. We would love to hear everyone else's thoughts in the comment section. And again, I hope no one thinks that we're being flippant about this discussion, because I know that it's a sensitive topic for a lot of people, but we are interested in exploring this dynamic. So we'd love for you to share your stories and your thoughts in the comments.
And the discussion continues.
And the discussion continues. That's right.
As friends.
Only as friends.
Yeah.
At Mormon Expression.
Leah may or may not have her hand on my leg right now.
Oh, boy.
But thanks for joining us.
Imagine.
We'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Lindsay.